Okay, good evening everyone, and welcome to this once-off session that we're going to have tonight, which we're doing in honor of the upcoming Chag, the upcoming festival, the festival of Shavuot, which begins this coming Motzei Shabbat, this coming Saturday night and Sunday, and then Sunday night and Monday. Shavuot is a very, very fundamental festival. It's the day we commemorate the anniversary of the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, which happened over 3,300 years ago. And on some level, unfortunately, Shavuot is a little bit forgotten sometimes. Everyone knows, of course, about Pesach and makes a big deal out of Pesach, and rightfully so. Everyone makes a huge deal out of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot to some degree. But Shavuot, not so much. But upon reflection, really, if you think about it, Shavuot is really the foundation of all the other festivals to a certain degree, because Shavuot is when we actually became we became the nation of God. So let's just give a bit of context before we go deep into the Kabbalah of what happened in Mount Sinai. But just to understand that the Jews left Egypt on Pesach. Were counted 49 days, eventually arrived at the desert of Sinai, as the Torah tells us, and it was the day of the 6th of Sivan, or the 7th of Sivan, depending on which opinion we go by, that the God revealed himself on Mount Sinai and gave us the Torah. Now, what does it mean he gave us the Torah? So often people assume what it means is we talk about the revelation of the Ten Commandments, which is true. Of course, God did communicate the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, but it wasn't just the knowledge, it wasn't just the content of the Ten Commandments that we received on Shavuot. It's much deeper than that. So just to recap, just very briefly, what actually happened at Mount Sinai? Now, I say that because when we examine Mount Sinai, we understand that everything about Jewish identity, everything about Jewish belief, stems from the Mount Sinai revelation. Some of you might be familiar with the song that is sung in many synagogues on Friday night, Yigdal Elokim Chai, where it really is a summary of the 13 principles of faith that the Rambam Maimonides lays out as the fundaments of Jewish belief. The eighth one of the 13 is the belief in the divinity of the Torah, the eternity of the Torah, the truth of the Torah as it was given at Sinai. So at Sinai, on Mount Sinai, God gave us the Torah. He gave us both what we call the written Torah and the oral Torah. And that's the eighth one of the 13 principles of faith. But in truth, that's the most fundamental one, because everything else, all the other principles of faith, we know and we accept and we connect to because of the Sinai revelation. In other words, it all comes from the fact that was the time that we experienced the absolute moment of clarity. God revealed himself like no other time. And the entire Jewish nation, we are taught, all 3 million or so of the Jewish people at the time, the physical people, together with the souls, all the future souls, all our souls, we believe we're all present at Mount Sinai, all connected to God at that moment, and all witnessed the clarity that took place at Mount Sinai. So what actually happened? So first of all, interesting, just to point out a few things. It was at that moment when we stood at Har Sinai. It really began with Pesach when we left Egypt, but we know that Shavuot, the giving of the Torah, was really the destination, it was the goal of the exodus of Egypt. Just take you back a little bit to the story of the burning bush. When Moses stands in front of the burning bush, God reveals himself at the burning bush. It's there where he appoints Moses as the leader, tells him to go back to Pharaoh and tell him to release the Jewish people. But there's an interesting sentence that God says when he reveals himself to Moses at the burning bush. In fact, the burning bush, we are taught, was on Mount Sinai. This is long before the Jews left Egypt. Where God says to Moses, When you take out this nation from Egypt, they will serve me, they will serve God on this mountain. In other words, this is the goal of the Exodus of Egypt. The goal of the Exodus of Egypt was for the Jewish people to reach Mount Sinai. Because it was at Mount Sinai, we are taught, that we fully became God's nation. We became a unit, we became one. In other words, up until then, even though we were descendants of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, and so on, but we never intrinsically, we were never spiritually or halachically bound together as one. When did that happen? At Mount Sinai. What else happened at Mount Sinai? We entered into a relationship with God. The Talmud refers to the giving of the Torah as the wedding, so to speak, between God and the Jewish people. It was at that moment that God committed to the Jewish people. He committed to be their God for eternity. He committed that even if there will come a time where we would stray, as we read about in this past week's parsha, and temporarily God might abandon us or send us into exile or whatever the case is, but He'll always come back, He'll always be our God, He will always be our Father in heaven. At the same time, we committed to God. We said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will observe, we will do what God wants from us, and we will understand, we will learn, we will study. So that relationship, that bond between us and God, not just as someone who tells us what to do, but actually as a real relationship, happened at Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, we were also given the gift of learning, the gift of education, something that has remained with the Jewish people throughout the ages, throughout the centuries. In fact, if you examine Jewish history historically, we talked about this the other night. If you examine Jewish history historically, the secret to our survival, the secret to our continuity, the constant that remained with the Jewish people during the ups and downs, the highs and the lows, every single land we were in, one thing that remained constant throughout from Mount Sinai onwards was the ability to learn, the education, the commitment to Torah learning, and to educating ourselves in God's wisdom. So all of that happened at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai really becomes the foundation of everything else we observe. In fact, the Rambam, Maimonides, tells us a very interesting thing. You know, we have 613 mitzvot. Some of them were actually given to us before Mount Sinai. So for example, the mitzvah of Brit Milah, of circumcising our male children, that was given to Abraham. Certain mitzvot were given to Isaac, to Yaakov, and so on. However, says Maimonides, that's all true, but, in fact, we even refer to the circumcision. When we circumcise a child, we refer to that as the Brit Shel Avraham Avinu, the covenant, the circumcision of Abraham. But yet, the reason we observe that mitzvah is because it was recommanded at Mount Sinai. In other words, everything that we do Jewishly, everything that we are, all is taken from that moment, that magical moment, the dramatic event, the most critical event in Jewish history, Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, which took place at Mount Sinai. And it's that event, that experience, that we remember, but not just remember, we try to re-experience on Shavuot. The Midrash tells us that if we go to the synagogue on Shavuot and we are present, particularly if we go to the synagogue, we are present when they read the Ten Commandments and they read about the Sinai event, says the Midrash, it's as if we are actually standing at Har Sinai and re-experiencing the whole story. That's why, just to mention, it's actually important, if one can, to be in shul, to be in synagogue on the Sunday morning when they read the Ten Commandments, to re-experience Har Sinai. Okay, so that's Shavuot in a nutshell. Of course, as Jews, we connect every festival to a food, and although there's not specific mitzvot, there's no specific rituals on Shavuot as there is on Pesach, like the Seder, or on Sukkot, like the Sukkah, or the Lulav, but nevertheless, they're still accustomed to eat milk products on Shavuot, especially during the day, cheese, cheesecake, blintzes, whatever the case is. Many reasons are given for it. One of them is that milk is chesed. It represents the concept of chesed mystically, and the kindness, and that's the gift that God gave us, the Torah. Also, the gematria, the numerical value of milk, of chalav, is 40. And we know that after the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, Moses went up on the mountain for sets of 40 days to learn the oral Torah, to learn the entire Torah, the mitzvot, and so on. So that's another reason. Many, many reasons given why we eat milk products on Shavuot. I'm just mentioning a few. Maybe if we have time, we'll come back and explore some of the others. Okay. So that's just an introduction and a bit of a context of what Shavuot is all about and what happened at Mount Sinai when we received the Torah. But I want to share with you a few deeper ideas of why Shavuot took place when it did, why the Sinai revelation came 7 weeks after they left Egypt, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to share with you two main concepts. When we have time, we'll do a third. I'm going to share a screen so we can follow inside. Uh-oh, where is it? I think it's this one. Yep. Okay, so one of the books of Tanakh is the Song of Songs, called Shir HaShirim. In Shir HaShirim, King Solomon very poetically and beautifully describes the relationship between God and the Jewish people and the Torah like a husband and a wife. It's on the surface a very romantic book of Tanakh. It gives very deep and graphic sort of examples and imagery of the love that exists between God and the Jewish people, similar to a husband and a wife. And it's a very cryptic sort of book, and it needs to be deciphered as it is by the commentaries and by the mystics and so on and so forth. One of the verses in Shir HaShirim is this one. I'll read it in Hebrew and we'll translate it and I'll explain it. It's the Jewish people talking to God and saying the following: Moshcheni, draw me after you. Acharecha narutza, after you we will run. We will run towards you. Right? And then it ends off, Heviani Hamelech Chadarav, the king has brought me to his inner chambers. Yeah. So that's the verse. Now, the mystics tell us, the commentaries tell us, that this pasuk, this verse, is divided into three. It's the first one where we talk about God drawing us close, right? That's referring to Pesach, when he took us out of Egypt and he made us close to him. When it says Narutza, we will run after you, that's referring to the Omer, the time of the Omer, the time we're in now, the time between Pesach and Shavuot. Hevi ani hamelech chadarav, the king has brought us, me, into his chambers, that's referring to the event of Sinai, when God bonded with us with an incredible bond through the Sinai revelation, through Har Sinai. Okay? That's the three events. Let's just understand, let's summarize it. So there's Pesach, when we left Egypt. There's the period of the Omer, when we go after God, so to speak. And then there's Matan Torah, when God gave us the Torah, when he brought us into his chambers. When we learn Torah, we are taught we become one with God, because God is one with his Torah, as the Zohar says, Oraita v'kutshabricho kulachad, God and his Torah are one, and we are drawn after him. When we come into his chambers, we become one with him, intimate with him. That's the event of Sinai. That's the Matan Torah experience. Okay. So we have to understand a few things in this pasuk to give us the depth of the sequence of these three events, the Kabbalistic sequence between these three events. It's interesting that when we talk about Pesach, right, we talk about God drawing us, but not just drawing us. The digduk, the grammar in the verse is Moshcheni, draw me, in the singular, draw me. Not you pulling us, you pulling me towards you. Right? But then the verse suddenly switches and says, we will run after you. So number one, it's not God drawing us anymore, it's we running after God. And it's not I am running after God, it's we are running after God. So what does that mean? And then it switches back to what God does, and it switches back to singular. God has brought me to his inner chamber. So what's going on here? Starts off with God drawing me, but me in the singular. then we are going to run, but it's we are going, not he's drawing us. And then he brought me to his chamber, again back to the singular. So to understand this, and to understand what actually happened in the whole event, we have to understand the goal of the Sinai revelation. The goal of the Sinai revelation is that God enters into a relationship with the Jewish people, right? He enters into a relationship with each and every one of us. He chooses us as his nation, and he enters into a relationship with us. But that relationship that God enters into with us, he enters into a relationship with us, the whole of us. And what do I mean by the whole of us? And this is where it takes us back to the beginning of the verse. We know something we've talked about many times. We know that we each have two parts to us. As the book of Tanya explains, in fact, the book of Tanya is based on this concept, that every Jew has two souls. We have what's called the Nefesh Elokit, the godly soul. And we have the Nefesh Habamit, known as the animal soul. So let's just break that down a little bit. Two forces within ourselves, which are in constant tension with each other. That's the complexity of the human being, right? The godly soul is the godly spark which is within us. It's the force which in us that is drawn towards spirituality, godliness. It's the force within us that yearns to connect with God. It's the force within us that pursues selflessness and godliness and meaning and purpose and so on. That's the godly soul. The animal soul is the soul within us, the force within us, which is materialistic. It's the force within us, also from God, of course, but that is interested in one thing, and that's self-survival, which in itself is not a bad thing. But also, it's the force within us which is drawn towards self-preservation, and therefore it becomes a force of egocentricity. It becomes a force of materialism, of pursuit of pleasure, and pursuit of short-term survival, disregarding the long-term purpose, long-term future, so to speak, long-term overall meaning that we live for, right? Now, there's a famous problem, okay? And everyone could relate to this. How sometimes we have a sudden inspiration, right? I don't know, it could be an amazing story we've heard. It could be an amazing Yom Kippur experience. It could be a miracle that took place, whatever the case is. But we all know we have moments in our lives where we suddenly feel tremendously inspired and uplifted. And it's those moments where we decide, you know what, we're just going to do something good. We're going to live by our values more. We're going to be more spiritual, more godly, and so on and so forth. And then suddenly it dissipates. After a while, it dissipates. And we kind of back to business, back to normal life. What's going on? Why is that? Why is it so difficult sometimes to sustain the inspiration? And the reason is, the depth of the reason is, it goes back to the two forces. You see, what happens is as follows. The part of us that is godly, i.e. the godly soul, doesn't need much to inspire it, right? Sometimes we live our life in a very mundane way, very materialistic, whatever the case is, and our godly soul is somewhat suppressed. But if there's something that triggers and inspires and infuses the godly soul with strength and inspiration, suddenly it wakes up, right? It wakes up. So in those moments of inspiration, what has happened? What has happened is that our soul is on fire. So you can come sometimes, you know, at the end of Ne'ilah, end of Yom Kippur, and we're all fired up. But actually, we're not fired up completely. Not the whole of us is fired up. What has actually happened is that our animal soul has gone to sleep, and our soul, our godly soul, is fired up and all full of inspiration. Right. In other words, we as human beings, the animal part of us, the animalistic part of us, has not intrinsically changed. It's the same. It's just gone to sleep. It's been anesthetized. So it's like two forces fighting with each other, and suddenly the one gets an adrenaline, a sort of an infusion, and just suppresses the other one. But then with time, the other fighter wakes up and fights back. Why am I telling you all this? Because this is actually, we are taught, this is what happened when the Jews left Egypt. So we have to understand over here what actually took place. When the Jews were in Egypt, and I'm sorry to spend a few minutes on Pesach here, but it's very important to understand Shavuot, right? When the Jews left Egypt, when the Jews were in Egypt, they were a people who were very spiritually immature. They were very steeped in the immorality, the impurity, and what we call in Kabbalah the klipa, the forces of evil, forces of negativity that prevailed in Egypt, right? We had sunken. In fact, we are taught, our sages teach us, that the Jewish people had sunken into the 49th level of impurity when they left Egypt. In fact, they were so low, they were so down in the spiritual dumps that we are taught had they remained in Egypt for one more second, they would have been lost forever, so to speak. They would have been lost in what we call the 50th gate of impurity, almost a point of no return. And what happened? God took us out of Egypt. Now, we know that God took us out of Egypt is not just a geographical thing, and it's not just a physical freedom. We talk about Pesach, we talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim, the going out of Egypt, as a spiritual freedom, right? So that spiritual freedom came through the revelation of God. God revealed Himself to us. He exposed Himself. There was a sudden, amazing revelation of godliness that schlepped us out, that pulled us out of the spiritual Egypt. However, when we left Egypt, we were not ready for the Torah. Why? Because what does it mean that God pulled us out of Egypt? What it actually means is He only related to the soul. Our animalistic soul, our nefesh habamit, the mundane self, didn't change. Because we hadn't done anything to change it. So it remained the same. What happened was that we just were suddenly infused with this amazing revelation, this godly revelation, so we left. We were able to go out of the spiritual Egypt. But we weren't intrinsically different. You know, this is also hinted in a very famous idea that we find that when the Jews left Egypt, they left in a hurry. It says, Ki baracha'am, the nation fled, we ran away. And the question is always asked, what do you mean we ran away? Why are we running away? God took us out of Egypt. Why are we running? What are we running from? And the mystics explain that kibaracha am, that we ran away, means that we ran away from ourselves. We ran away from our own bad, our own negativity, our own materialism. We hadn't changed, we just ran away from ourselves, so to speak. We were expressing our soul, we were being carried by our neshama, by our soul. But the physical, material part of who we are had not changed at all. With that concept, we can understand the first part of this verse. Step one, meaning the exodus from Egypt, is as the Pasuk says over here, Moshcheni, draw me. Singular. Who's the singular here? Meaning, first of all, it's God drawing me. He's doing the work. And therefore, He's doing the work. Who's He relating to? Who's listening to Him? Which part of me is being drawn after Him? Just the godly soul. My animal soul is remaining the same. My animal soul has not changed. I haven't intrinsically changed my character, my emotions, my cognition. The me, the physical me, hasn't really changed. It's God drawing the singular me, meaning the godly soul, is going out of Egypt. Which is step one. There was no other way to do it. The materialistic part of who we are, the animal soul of who we were, was not ready to come out of Egypt. That needed a lot of work. Right? But the revelation of God was enough to talk and to draw out our soul and to put our godly soul on fire, so we were able to experience the exodus from Egypt. But that's not good enough for the giving of the Torah. Because the goal of the exodus of Egypt is the giving of the Torah in Sinai, but that's a relationship which needs to take place. The whole of us has to connect to God. Every part of us, both the animal soul, the godly soul, and the animal soul. So therefore what happens is, as soon as we leave Egypt, God gives us another mitzvah. And the mitzvah is the counting of the Omer. Now I want to just talk about that for a second. Why do we count the Omer during this time? Right? So if you look into the Chumash, the Torah tells us that on the second day of Pesach, right? The second day of Pesach, we should start counting the Omer. Why is it called the Omer? Because in temple times, the Omer, the word Omer actually means a measurement of flour. The way it worked was, the Omer is a certain measurement of flour. So the second day of Pesach, God actually commanded us that we need to offer up in the temple a special sacrifice, a flour sacrifice, called the Korban Mincha, which should be made of barley. Now, what's the uniqueness of barley? There are many, many sacrifices in the Torah that are wheat, that are flour, but most of them are wheat. There's only two exceptions. One of the exceptions is the Omer Korban, known as the second day Omer, the second day of Pesach. And the Omer Korban was specifically barley, not wheat. Right? It was barley. Now what? And then the Torah says, from the time that you harvest the barley and you bring the sacrifice, you shall count 7 weeks, right? 49 days, 7 weeks, and then the 50th day will be the festival of Shavuot. So what's going on here? So the Talmud tells us an interesting thing. Today this is not so, the way that, you know, today we're sort of very into different types of herbs and grains and all kinds of things, so we eat all these kinds of things. But in ancient times, wheat was known as the human food. Human grain was wheat. Barley was animal grain, right? Which is why normally in the temple, all flour offerings are normally wheat flour, right? When it comes to the Omer Korban was barley. Specifically barley. Why? Because it's symbolic of exactly what God asks us to do. On the first day of Pesach, He says, I'm doing the job. I'm schlepping you out of Egypt. I'm talking to your soul. I'm lighting your soul so it should be on fire. But now you have to start a process of changing your animal soul, of refining the character of your animal soul, refining your personality, refining the human being, refining the coarseness within you. The animalistic components of who you are need to be refined and brought on the program so it becomes part of the thing. That's a job that we have to do. God doesn't do that for us. God starts us off. He ignites the soul. But we then have to go towards God, right? That's why the next part of the pasuk is, Acharecha narutza, we will run after you. This time we are doing the job, and it's not singular. It's plural, meaning it's both the godly soul and the animal soul. We're both running after you. Now, what's the idea of 7 weeks, therefore? So we know like this. And this is an important Kabbalistic idea as well. Both the animal soul and the godly soul are both governed by 10 powers, known as Chochmah, Binah, Daat, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, and so on. Those 10 powers, the first three are cognitive, intellectual, Chochmah, Binah, and Daat, and then the other 7 are emotional. Midot, emotions. Now, although both the godly soul and the animal soul both are governed by 10 powers, we are taught that the godly soul, the primary force in the godly soul is intellectual. The godly soul is a soul that understands God. It is a soul that has deep insight into God and godliness. Of course, bringing to emotion, but the primary force is its power of thought, the power of intellect. Whereas the animal soul, its main force, its main primary force, is emotional. It's impulsive. It's like animalistic. The animal part of who we are responds with great impulse, with emotional responses, right? That's why God gives us 7 weeks when He tells us that after the first day of Pesach, when He has ignited our soul, our godly soul, and our godly soul has schlepped us out of Egypt. Incidentally, the godly soul and the three levels of intellect in the godly soul is hinted in the three matzot that we have on the Seder plate, right? The three matzot, which is Chochmah, Binah, and Daat, the three cognitive powers of the godly soul. But then we have to set into motion where we refine our animal soul, which is mainly the work we do on an emotional level, controlling our impulses, controlling our temptation, controlling our negative emotions such as jealousy and hate and resentment and so on and so forth. And that is 7, the focus on the number 7. That's why 7 weeks. 7 weeks, 49 days. The reason is because 49 days each week is divided into seven, because we are taught that the seven midot, the seven emotions that we have, intertwine with each other. So each one is made up of seven. So for example, you have chesed, and then gevura of chesed, and the tiferet of chesed, and so on and so forth. Each one interrelates with the other seven, so you have 49. But it's in 7 weeks divided into 49 days divided into 7 weeks. So that's why Sacharecha Narutza, we are running after God's time. God's not doing the work, we're changing ourselves. That's why the period of the Omer is a time of great character development, great personal growth. We're now in our seventh week, we're now in our seventh final Midah, the Midah of Malchut, where we're working towards getting to the end of the 49, being ready to receive the Torah on Shavuot. When we finish that process, the symbolism is that we finish the idea of then being completely one. We brought union, we brought oneness to between the two souls, right? For oneness. In other words, the idea is that God created us with a godly soul and an animal soul. The two souls have tension and conflict with each other. The goal, of course, is to bring them together. As it says in the Shema, when we say the Shema, the famous idea, we say, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha. You shall love God, your God, with your whole heart. Now, if you know a bit of Hebrew, in Hebrew, the word for heart is lev, heart, right? Your heart is libcha. It has one letter bet in it. Yet in the Shema, it says b'chol levavcha, with your whole heart, but it says the letter bet twice. So our sages tell us, because it's b'shnei yitzarecha, the idea is to serve God with both forces within you, both the animal soul and the godly soul. The animal soul should come on board, and the animal soul should come under the mastery and the guidance of the godly soul, and they should be brought together in oneness to serve God. And that's the symbolism of the Omer, where we work through the 7 weeks, we work through the seven emotions, the seven principal forces of the animal soul, and we bring it under its refinement process, we bring it together in line with the godly soul, creating a oneness between the godly soul and the animal soul. And it's at that point, God says, now you're ready to get the Torah. Now you're ready to enter into a deep relationship with God through the Sinai revelation. And that's why the third part of the verse is, Hevi ani hamelech chadarav, the king has brought me into his inner chambers. We switch back to singular, but it's a different type of singular this time. In the first part of the verse, the singular means just part of me, the godly soul, to the exclusion of the animal soul. Then we work together, both animal soul and godly soul. The end is we create oneness, so we're back to the singular, where God now brings me, meaning the whole of me, the godly soul and the animal soul, into his inner chamber to connect with him in an intimate way, which is the concept of giving the Torah, which happened on Shavuot, creating that bond and that covenant and that eternity between us and God. Okay, so that's one idea of the Sinai revelation. Now, I want to go to the next thing. I want to talk about the Ten Commandments. Everyone knows Ten Commandments. The revelation of what happened at Mount Sinai, where God revealed and he gave us the Ten Commandments. I think I've told this little story before, but I'll tell it again just in case you haven't heard it. My grandfather was a rabbi in a very big shul in South Africa. His name was Rabbi Eloy. He was the rabbi of the Berea Shul. And the Berea Shul many, many years ago went through a beautiful renovation. I don't remember the shul pre-renovation, it was before my time, but when I remember, grew up, I remember it in its beautiful sort of setting. And in South Africa, there was quite a common practice that the ceilings of the shul be very, very high. Obviously, because it was double story, you had the men downstairs, the women upstairs, and very often on top of the ark would be the choir room, where the choir would actually be in like a separate room, looking through into the shul, and sort of being communicating, so to speak, with the chazan, who would stand on the bimah the other side of the shul. And Berea Shul at the time had a very, very beautiful, very famous chazan. His name is Chazan Mandel, and a choir, a very, very good choir. When they renovated the shul and they made this beautiful ark with two wings, it was very magnificent. They made these like gold chains running through down from the choir room. And on the gold chains, they placed like two tablets, the Luchot, the Ten Commandments, you know, having many, many shuls. Just after they re-entered the shul to start using it for services after the renovation, my grandfather was sitting in his office, and there's a bang at the door. And it's the choir master. His name was Gus Levy, the choir master. He barges into my grandfather's office and he says, "Rabbi, the Ten Commandments are in my way." What he meant to say was that they erected these two beautiful tablets on these chains, and he couldn't see out the choir room. He couldn't see the chazan properly, which wasn't good because he needed to be able to sort of synchronize the chazan and the choir to make sure that everything is going up there. So he says, "Rabbi, the Ten Commandments are in my way." Without missing a beat, my grandfather looked up from his desk and he said, "Gus, don't worry, the Ten Commandments are in lots of people's way." So that was his answer. Anyway, I'm not sure what they did at the end practically, but that was his answer. So Ten Commandments is what we commemorate on Shavuot. But when we read the Torah, we read the Ten Commandments, I want to show you something about what they mean. Well, in Hebrew, the Ten Commandments are called Aseret HaDibrot. Incidentally, a bit of a misconception, the translation Ten Commandments is actually a mistranslation. There are actually not Ten Commandments in the Ten Commandments. There's actually more than Ten Commandments. But some of the commandments include a few mitzvot. The translation of Aseret HaDibrot is Ten Statements. That's what it is, Ten Statements. Right? Now, we know the number 10 is something we find a number of times in the Torah. So I wanted to show you an introductory verse. An introductory verse to the Ten Commandments. Bearing in mind, when God gave the Ten Commandments on Har Sinai, on Mount Sinai, the Aseret HaDibrot, they were actually symbolic of the entire Torah. An amazing thing, if you count up the letters in the Ten Commandments, you'll see there are 620 letters. We know that we have 613 mitzvot, plus we have what's called the seven rabbinic mitzvot, altogether make 620, which, by the way, is the same numerical value as the word keter, which is crown, the crown of Torah, 620 mitzvot. So the entire Torah really is hinted in the Ten Commandments, and that's why God revealed himself at Sinai. He communicated to us the Ten Commandments, but really it's referring to the entire, he gave us the entire Torah. Just before the Ten Commandments, there's an introductory verse. And the verse goes like this, that's number 2 here on this handout. And it reads, "Vayedaber Elohim," and God spoke. Elohim spoke. Elohim is one of the names of God, right? "Et kol ha-dvarim ha'ele," all of these things, dvarim is like the dibrot, "leimor," saying. Okay. Now, there's a number of problems with this verse. First of all, the one that the commentaries all highlight is this last word over here. I'm just going to highlight it so you know what I'm talking about, right? This last word, "leimor." Why is it problematic? We have this word many times in the Torah. For example, every time God introduces a new mitzvah, very, very often in the Torah, we have the verse, "Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe leimor." God spoke to Moses saying. What does saying mean? Like every word in the Torah is exact. What is the word "leimor" saying? So normally what it means is, God spoke to Moses. "Leimor" means not saying, but to say to someone else. He said, I'm giving you this communication for you to pass it on further. So God spoke to Moses for him to "leimor," to say it to everyone else. Right? That's how it normally works. The problem is, in this case, it doesn't make sense. Why not? Because we believe that every single Jew was at Mount Sinai, including us. We were all there. When God spoke, he didn't speak to Moses to say it to us. He spoke to every single Jew. Every single soul was at Matan Torah. So why, "Vayedaber Elohim," God spoke, "et kol ha-dvarim ha'ele leimor"? Why leimor? To say it to who? To communicate it to who? We all heard it. Every single one of us heard it. God was talking to us individually. So what does it mean, leimor? Number one. Number two, we need to understand what is the difference. You know, in Hebrew, there's different words for communication. The two most common words, which we find in the Torah, is dibur, like vayedaber, dibur, speaking, and amira, saying, like lemor, comes the word emor, amira, dibur and amira. So, what is the difference between these two? Why do they get used like sort of interchangeably? What is the significance? Like, for example, this word, this verse will start off with Vayedaber, God spoke, and end off with not Lidaber, but Lemor, to say, Amira. What's the difference? So here's the interesting thing. Here's the crux of what Shavuot is really all about and what the Torah given to us is all about. The number 10, we have 10 commandments, 10 statements really, as they're called, Aseret HaDibrot, right? Where do we find the 10 to begin with? So the 10 goes all the way back to the genesis of the world, the beginning of Torah, where God creates the universe. And Pirkei Avot tells us, Ethics of the Fathers tells us, that when God created the world, He created it with 10 sayings. So, interesting, God creates the world with 10 sayings, and then at Mount Sinai, He gives us the 10 commandments or 10 statements. However, they're called very differently. When God created the world, the 10 sayings are called Asara Ma'amarot, 10 sayings, using the word Amira. When God gives us the 10 commandments, they're not called Asara Ma'amarot, they're called Aseret HaDibrot. So with the 10 sayings of creation, they're called 10 Ma'amarot, Amira. We use the word, we use the term Amira. With the 10 commandments, the term Dibur, speak, speech is used, Aseret HaDibrot. So it's Bedafke, in other words, it's specifically that way. The creation is through the Amira. Like, in fact, throughout the 6 days of creation, if you look in Bereshit, it's always Vayomer Elohim, God said Amira, all the time Amira, and we say Asura Mamarot. Whereas the Torah is Vayedaber, Aseret HaDibrot, Dibur. Why is that? And the answer is the following. The answer is that what's the difference between Dibur and Amira? Dibur is clarity. When you speak to someone and you give clear instruction, and they know exactly what you're talking about, and there's no ambiguity, there's no, nothing's cryptic, that's dibur. Dibur is revealed, open communication, clear communication with absolute clarity and unambiguity. That's dibur. Amira, on the other hand, refers to nuanced speech, cryptic speech. Sometimes Amira is like body language, where it's hard to interpret. Or someone talks in riddles. He says something, but not, it's not clear. You can't make out exactly what they mean. It's almost like code form speech. We have to decode in order to understand. That's the essential difference, according to many commentaries. If that's the case, we can understand exactly the difference between the creation of the world and the revelation of Mount Sinai. They're two opposites. When God created the world, so the mechanism of creation, whatever that means, that's a separate discussion to understand exactly what that means. But the mechanism of creation is through speech. God created the world with the mechanism of speech. But it's speech which is cryptic. It's hard to understand. Meaning, God created a world that by design He was hidden. You look at the world, you do not see God in an obvious way. It is difficult to discover God behind the creation. It is difficult to notice the godliness behind everything that was created. It is easy to look at the world and to see it as an independent creation without a creator, God forbid. We know it's from God, but God is hidden in the creation. He created a world by design, on purpose, intentionally, to be a place where He was not obvious, where it's dark, where we cannot see Him automatically, We have to work hard to decode the communication and to see the word of God and the power of God and the energy of God as the basis for everything that exists. That is why when God created the world, He created with 10 ma'amarot. He created the world with amirah, saying, because that's cryptic communication. It's communication where it's difficult to decode, difficult to see. The Sinai revelation is exactly the opposite. The Sinai revelation is that the whole world went quiet. And that moment of Matan Torah was a moment of absolute clarity. There was nothing ambiguous about Matan Torah. It became completely and absolutely obvious to everyone that it was God. And in fact, that power continues on in the Torah. The Torah is what reveals, the Torah is what brings clarity to creation. In other words, God created the world to be a place which is cryptic, cryptic communication. It is up to us to clarify. It is up to us to bring the clarity into creation and to reveal the godliness, the purpose, the value, the holiness, the godliness behind everything. It's up to us to reveal God in this confused creation. The tool for us to do that is the moral compass and the moral code which God gave us at Mount Sinai, which is the Torah, all hinted in Aseret HaDibrot. That's why the Ten Commandments are called Aseret HaDibrot, Dibur, which means clear language. It's Torah. Torah is clarity. Torah reveals the absolute morality and absolute truth, and it is the shining light and the moral compass to make, to bring clarity to a very cryptic world. That's why it's Aseret HaDibrot. It is Dibur, clear language. Now we can understand the Pasuk, the introductory verse to the Ten Commandments. Vayedaber Elohim, and God spoke, Dibur. He revealed Himself. He brought clarity. He spoke openly. He revealed Himself. He exposed Himself. It was a revelation of God at the highest order. Et kol hadvarim ha'ele, what was the purpose of all these Diburim, all these speaking, all these statements of clarity? So the Pasuk, the verse ends, Lemor. It was all to bring clarity to the Amirah. It was all to bring clarity to the crypticness, to the cryptic language, rooted in the 10 sayings of creation. This concept comes from the famous Maggid of Mezrich. He said that the whole point of the 10 commandments was to merge the 10 commandments with the 10 sayings of creation. Because the 10 sayings of creation is lemor, it's amirah, it's cryptic. We use the 10 commandments, the 10 statements, the 10 expressions of clarity to bring clarity to the 10 sayings of creation. And that's why the word lemor is there. Even though normally it means something different, but over here it means that God gave us the 10 statements, the 10 clear statements. To do what? Lemor. To bring them in, to reveal them in the 10 sayings of creation. In other words, so to summarize and to connect it to the previous concept, we are God's nation. We went out of Pesach, we went out of Egypt, just as our godly soul. God gives us 7 weeks of refinement where we bring the animal soul on board. We create a oneness between the animal soul and the godly soul. And then we're ready for God bringing us into His chamber, which is the giving of the Torah. But what's the purpose of the giving of the Torah? The purpose of the Torah is not just that we enter into a covenant with God, but that God gives us a mission. And the mission is, now that you have become close to me, says God, now that you have entered into this relationship with me, it is now your purpose to then bring this to the world, to brighten up the world, to reveal God in the world. Vayedaber Elohim, to bring the clarity of Dibur, Lemor, into the Amirah, into the cryptic language of the 10 sayings of creation. Now, of course, that happens every year. We re-experience this concept every year. But of course, the ultimate goal of this, the ultimate achievement of this mission will be when Mashiach comes, who will complete the job. And that's why we are taught that when God revealed Himself on Har Sinai, it was a sneak preview to what it'll look like when Mashiach comes, the absolute clarity in the world. Because as we continue on our mission to take the Ten Commandments and to bring them into the Ten Sayings of creation, we are making the world a better place, we are making the world a clearer place, and we are preparing the world for the ultimate clarity, the ultimate reenactment of the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, which will be when Mashiach comes. So that's just a little bit of an understanding of what Har Sinai, the Sinai revelation, is all about. And once again, let me just finish up by saying that we sort of try to re-experience this every single year. One of the ways we do that is to be in shul on the Sunday morning to hear the Ten Commandments as they're being read from the Torah, which becomes as if we are standing in Har Sinai once again. Shavuot is also a time to recommit ourselves to Jewish learning, to recommit ourselves to really educating ourselves and filling our brains and minds and hearts with the wisdom of Hashem, the gift that God gave us of education, of Jewish learning, and to bring with it all the blessings that comes with the learning of Torah and the connection to God. So I want to wish everyone, of course, a good week and a Shabbat Shalom, but particularly a Chag Sameach and Shavuot, and we should all upgrade our commitment to Jewish learning and Jewish connection. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Rabbi. It was very interesting.
You're very welcome. Thank you.